This is another episode of Dear Analyst, and today I'm super excited to have Sarah Krasnick on the podcast. She is a data engineering consultant who has had a variety of experiences, and we're going to have her chat through some of the projects and analytics she's done in her previous roles. But Sarah, thank you so much for being on the show today.
It's my pleasure, Al.
To get things started, can you first introduce like your background, who you are, what you've done in the past?
Yeah, absolutely. Through my time in the analytics space, I've been both a data scientist, data analyst, but for most of the time, a data engineer. And really in my variety of roles as a data engineer, I've kind of led a team that's responsible for the data platform as a whole. So that's everything from infrastructure to transformation, more of the traditional like analytics engineering now, as well, even in some places as the BI side as well. So wide variety of things, dabbled in machine learning, but really just like building systems.
Very cool. And I know you had a really wide ranging career leading up to being a consultant today. I guess maybe we can start off by chatting about some of the projects you worked on at Perpay, your previous employer. I believe you had talked about a project relating to sending customer data to a marketing tool. I'm wondering if you can tell us more about the problem you're trying to solve with this project and what the ultimate kind of like final product, if you will, was for this project at Perpay, and also what Perpay is too.
For sure. So I guess to start broadly about Perpay, Perpay is in the buy now, pay later space. So both an e-commerce platform as well as kind of a lender, again, from the buy now, pay later side. So really the problem that I was really trying to help the marketing team tackle was sending more personalized email campaigns. And this is, I think, a common problem or common optimization point at many companies, both in B2C as well as B2B. So really, the marketing team onboarded Iterable, which is a marketing tool that does exactly that. So if you put in data about information about your customers, you can send more personalized emails. For example, the kind of most common example is kind of like abandoned cart emails. So, right, someone carted something, they didn't check out, and you want to remind them that there's something in their cart. Some people love them, some people hate them, but the point is that like they really are effective. And the more personal you can get with your emails and the more conversions you're going to get, and that's going to really lead to like a growing business and just like better performance from the marketing team. So where kind of data engineering comes into that is that information about what's in someone's cart or, you know, other more personal information about how people are using the platform, that needs to get into the marketing tool itself. And not only does it need to get in there, we need to also define like what data do we actually need? What format does it need to come in to get into the tool? So this is, I would say, the kind of classic use case for, you know, whatever you want to call it, like data activation, reverse ETL, operational analytics. But the point is that data lives in the warehouse and we want to get it into kind of the operational tool. In Perpay's case, it was Iterable. So I'm kind of working backwards here from the requirements and the problem to the actual solution. So the actual solution had many different iterations. Initially, this was at this point a couple years ago. And initially, we started with implementing a solution in-house of just so transforming the data. And we were, I think Perpay is a very kind of data-driven organization, or at least that's what I found when I worked there and really like that about working there. And so a lot of the transformations, I mean, there actually wasn't much transformation that needed to happen once it came to sending the data, because a lot of it was kind of typical things that we want to know about our customers anyway, whether it's in a marketing tool or not. But really the hardest problem was taking the data from the warehouse and loading it into the tool. And that was loading data using an orchestrator. So we used Airflow, taking data from the warehouse and then hitting Iterable's API to kind of upload the data. And as I think Pedram of High Touch wrote a post about like why you don't want to build these systems yourself. And I largely agree with him because it's very difficult when you're interacting with APIs. And if you want to send that data to a different tool for a different use case, then you kind of need to start from scratch in terms of understanding custom APIs. And so that proved fairly difficult just with rate limits and understanding what is in Iterable and what is the state and what are the diffs and the rows that need to change so we don't have to send all the information over and over again, even if it didn't change. So those were kind of some of the difficulties, but what we ended up doing is implementing that in-house. And then later when we kind of proved that out, it was used very heavily. It was relied upon by marketing. They were kind of even working with data engineering and myself to kind of add different fields for different use cases, and kind of the need was growing. So we actually transitioned to a paid solution, namely Census, to just do that movement of data really from the warehouse to Iterable for us. So that we're really what we had to focus on as a data team was defining data, defining fields, and just making sure that the data is in the warehouse and then everything kind of flows from there.
Got it. Hearing you speak more in detail about this project gives me more context for why you wrote that blog post called about SASTA, which we'll get to later, but it's now starting to all come together in terms of like the context for that blog post, but we'll chat about that in a sec. In terms of just quick follow-up on this project, when you mentioned you didn't want, eventually you were building it in-house and then moved it over to this other solution called Census. I'm curious, like at what point in the journey did the data engineering team realize like we can't maintain this in-house, we should just like try to find like an off-the-shelf solution? Because to your point, like I think a lot of teams do to start building in-house and then like not sure when you decide to go to the paid solution or go to a paid vendor. I'm curious what that decision process was like for your team.
Yeah, so for my team, for the context of like working in a startup, being a small team, the key is kind of like ruthless prioritization. You're not going to be able to get to everything. And so you want to prioritize things that you kind of have some sort of like unique ability to do or like unique contribution. And so what I found was that as a data engineering team, we were spending too much time maintaining this system that I personally did not feel that I was uniquely positioned to maintain. I mean, anyone with any knowledge of APIs, like it has nothing to do with purpose specifically, or even, I mean, a little bit Iterable specifically, but because it's their API, but like anyone with a knowledge of APIs and just moving data from one place to another could maintain it. And so to me, this kind of stood out to me as more of a generic problem and something that we spent hours a month maintaining. And so there it was, the analysis was, how many hours do we spend maintaining this? What is the cost of a paid solution? And when does the cost of a paid solution, when is that lower than kind of really the time? I consider time, I mean, time is money. I say this like both in my professional and personal life, but you know, when does that balance? When is it actually cheaper to pay for a third-party tool? And so that's when that kind of decision was made. And I will say that this decision is going to be different depending on the size of the organization. So for example, if this was at Airbnb or like some other organization, either we would just have loads of people to be able to maintain internally or build a better reverse ETL system, or just kind of we would have the people to throw out the problem. But at a startup, usually, I mean, honestly, every startup that I've talked to, like the biggest issue is hiring. Like hiring is hard. Hiring good people is hard. Right now, there's like, there's a lot of talent and there's a lot of talent to be had and everyone wants that talent. And so having the people at the company do what they're uniquely good at was really this like ruthless prioritization that kind of led to the decision.
Got it. Makes sense. Yeah. The fact that you did the, your own analysis of like the cost of the vendor versus maintaining a house, like I think that's a really important analysis to do for just maintaining efficiencies and stuff. That's great. I guess moving on to another project that you mentioned, which was creating a forecasting tool or mechanism at another company you worked at called OneMain. I think what's interesting about this project from what I remember is that, well, I guess backing up, like a lot of data analysts, data engineers I talk to talk about the data transformation, getting the data ready. And then the fun part is actually doing the forecasting and doing all the analysis, presenting this to the business. And I'm curious what your team had to do to build this forecast mechanism tool so that it could help with, you know, more efficiencies and better analysis for analysts at the company.
So the way that this project at OneMain differed from the project at Perpay is that the solution actually already existed before I even came onto the team. So there a forecasting process for, so I guess a little bit of context. So OneMain is a private lender, so kind of also in the fintech space, but really the affiliate marketing team, they were responsible for marketing the loans that OneMain had and having them show up on Credit Karma, NerdWallet, you know, Lending Club, like kind of you name it, and just like prevalent in the ecosystem. And the analysis was really, in general, was making that more efficient, making us show up in the ecosystem more for less money and really optimizing conversion. And so from a forecasting perspective, how we can forecast the, you know, cost per loan or cost per conversion, as well as kind of the number of loans coming in, that really influences our forecast for like the number of loans from our business unit, right? And if you think of different business units, there could be like direct mail, there could just be, you know, Google searches, you name it. But the point is that we were kind of only responsible for the affiliate marketing. But I do think that the strategy kind of applies across marketing channels and, you know, organic channels. But the project itself was taking a forecast that was already built. And so I had no ownership of the logic, but more taking that from a manual process that kind of took hours to update with actuals every week in terms of answering the question of this week, how are we compared to the forecast for the month? And are we trending above or below where we should be? So to do that, actuals change every day. There's new data. There are new people coming onto the platform and, you know, new loans, so on and so forth. And so that took a very long time to update each week. So my job was taking that process and reducing the time it takes to update the numbers. So what that involved was automating SQL scripts to be able to run the transformations that were previously done sometimes in SQL, but it was kind of a series of things, sometimes in Excel, and displaying the actuals in Looker so that they could, so that just whenever you went there, you knew the actuals. If you did your updates on Mondays, they were there on Mondays. If you did the updates on Thursdays, they'd be there on Thursdays. And it was just kind of there. And all you had to do was take those numbers, put it in a slide deck, and kind of present it in the forum that, you know, the leadership or, you know, whoever was responsible for kind of understanding where we're trending, just put it in a slide deck because that's how they like to see it. So there, I would say it was really understanding the process that existed, understanding the tools that were already being used in maybe either other parts of the organization or even within our team, just used in different ways, and automating some processes, making things update automatically so that there was just less time needed for maintenance. And kind of my coworkers on the forecasting side could spend their time like making the forecast better as opposed to just like manually updating with actuals, which, you know, the former, right, making the forecast better, that's what they're uniquely positioned to do.
Got it. And so were the, before you implemented the solution, the forecasters were in charge of like updating the actuals and pulling from the database and then doing that kind of manual work? Was that what you, yes, what your solution kind of replaced? Okay, cool. And then I'm curious, like in terms of the impact, like were you able to like save, I don't know, like 5 hours, 10 hours a week per time, or even if it's qualitative feedback, I'm curious like how, what the efficiencies you drove were for your forecasting counterparts.
Yeah, from what I remember, I believe I saved about 20 hours of time a week, joint together by a bunch of people. And it took me maybe a couple weeks to build, maybe a month max. But if you imagine this forecasting process having existed probably for years before I came, then that month of time investment, right? It's 20 hours per week, that's like part-time. That's a solid half of your time. And so compounding that, right? It's like eventually that initial investment starts to pay off and you're kind of just in the gains territory.
Right. And I'm sure as one main's products and business lines get more complicated and more diverse, then it's probably going to exponentially increase the amount of manual work to update that forecast going forward, if there isn't an automated solution like what you built.
Exactly. And right. The other thing with automated solutions is that usually they are version controlled and exposed, and everyone can kind of see what happens. Anyone can update, and you can see how it changed over time. So that if someone asks, "Well, why did all of a sudden our forecast didn't change, but our actuals, right? We were trending higher, now we're below." Well, we can see, right? Oh, well, there was a change in how we got the actuals because we decided to, count something in a different way, or some definition changed, or something like that.
And when you say version control, was like your scripts like maintained on GitHub or something, or some other in-house tool?
Yeah, at OneMain specifically, I actually don't remember if they used GitHub or not, but it was the scripts were running on a schedule, and so they were somewhere where multiple people could access them, as opposed to just scripts on, for example, my computer or someone else's computer that just aren't really accessible to anyone else.
Got it. Okay. Moving on, I guess, changing gears to another project, and this is, I think I would position this as more of like the softer side of things, because I've talked to a few analysts who have done projects similar to this. I'm always curious to get other people's takes, because it's something that I think every data analyst or even business analyst has to do at some point in their career, is getting organizational buy-in into like a central dashboard or report. And I believe this was when you were working at a company called Slice, and I was wondering if you could tell us more about what Slice does and what this kind of central reporting tool that you're working on, what it involved in terms of herding the cats, as it were, to get people to buy into this solution.
Yeah, so a little bit of context. Slice, not the pizza company.
It's S-L-Y-C-E.
Yes, exactly. It was based in Philly. So Slice's core product was visual search. So via API or SDK, I think both were an offering, if I remember correctly. But basically an integration, right, within like Macy's or Home Depot or something like that, where you take a picture of a dress and then the results show you dresses at Macy's that are similar to the picture that you took. More recently, I believe they were acquired by Partium and went more into like the parts-driven search and the kind of Home Depot industrial route. But at the time, it was kind of a variety of part search and retail and a couple different areas. But the point is that the way that kind of the pricing worked was based on volume. Volume of what? Well, a core product is search. And there were different types of searches. So whether you uploaded an existing picture, whether you took a picture, or whether you kind of typed something, or maybe even like took a picture of text. So those were kind of different types of searches that require different operations to happen on Slice's end, which is again why they were kind of considered different things. But as you can imagine, even in my description, like they're kind of it's kind of fluid in terms of like text search versus a picture of text. Is that text or is that a picture? That's kind of, it's not particularly clear. And really it's just like, we can argue all day probably which one it is, but really the point is that like, there's just some decision and some agreement around how we define these different types of searches so that we can count them. And so really what this project was getting some sort of unity around a definition of what different types of searches were, And then that would lead to how do we now let's count them and get unity around what the counts are per week, per month, whatever it may be. So the former, this was like a lot of meetings, a lot of talking with sales, talking with product, talking with tech, about how do you cut right on behalf of sales, like understanding how do customers talk about search and how do they, right? How do customers expect our sales team to talk about search from the product perspective, like how do we display searches within the app or how do we do it like when it is customer facing? And does that differ from maybe the understanding that sales or customers, by customers, I mean Macy's, by product, by end users, I mean like the person using the Macy's app or something like that. And then lastly, tech, right? That's less related to what customers do or how sales teams talk about our product. It's more to do with like how the product works. And the other question that kind of comes up is, do we need to change how we bill or like, how do we even figure out, right? Like just because there are two different ideas of search, whether it be actual text or a picture of text, I guess I'm just like using that example because it's the most obvious one that really could go either way. Does that have a difference of like what happens on the back end? And so those three things, it's definitely a Venn diagram. Like there was some overlap and a decent amount of overlap, but there were also kind of other ideas that were mostly only relevant to product, mostly only relevant to sales, and mostly only relevant to tech. And it was really trying to get the other two to understand the position of, you know, the other team. And so with that, the output was a document that kind of defined the different types of searches and a dashboard that counted the numbers of searches that the sales team could send as reports to customers of Slice. So I kind of glossed over the counting metrics. And so obviously there's more engineering work there to make sure that we are capturing all the events and that there's like quality there in terms of making sure that the data represents reality. But I would say that was actually less of the work and more of the work was just gathering requirements. And even if we collect all of the data, we still have to understand like, how do we count it? And how do we look at it in the context of like what people understand and what people think about the product?
Very interesting. So I'm guessing this involved a lot of cross-functional meetings between different parties and just getting alignment essentially, right?
Yes, getting alignment, but also, right, this was one of my first projects. So a lot of it was like, I was kind of treating myself almost a little bit as a neutral third party, even though I wasn't a third party, I was an employee. But the point is that like, because I was new, I didn't really have a stake. And I mean, I technically sat on the tech team and I am technical. So I feel like I did have more of an understanding of that than sales per se, but I really tried to take a step back and, you know, bring everyone equally to the table so that we could gain that alignment and know one definition was prioritized over another. We just had to make decisions.
Got it. And kind of like a in the weeds question, I'm not sure if you know this, but as you were talking, I was thinking about prior to getting alignment on the definitions, I'm guessing there was already existing definition for what a search is that you were that the sales team perhaps was presenting to customers like Macy's. So after you agree on these new definitions, was a sales team kind of like, whoa, these numbers are so different, we can't present these to Macy's because that might have like impact on, you know, future sales or business, like, or did the numbers not change that much between the old and new definitions for customers?
Yeah, there definitely was a little bit of that. And I think the main reason for that was because one of the things that we were doing was also unifying all the data to be generated by one system, as opposed to using two different systems. And so by nature of using two different systems and two different ways of generating the data itself, let alone the definitions, but the data itself is different between the two different systems. And so there was a little bit of unification of like, of tooling and technical approach. And so that is something that we explained to our end customers and really was more of an effort of like efficiency and giving them a better product. And so that was more the kind of the spin that we took, because it was an important evolution of the product to be able to make a more efficient system, scale it better, have more monitoring, have more visibility of it, and just make search more performant, honestly. That was the main thing that we were trying to do, both from quality of results as well as like speed of response. And so to do that, we had to unify under one system, and that inherently meant some changes.
Got it. Very interesting. So I think to kind of wrap things up, one of the ways that I first kind of heard about you was through this really interesting blog post you put on your Substack called "What is SaaS Debt?" And I'll link to this and also in the show notes and part of your newsletter. And this blog post kind of, it spoke to many different things I'm interested in. It talks about SaaS tools, it talks about spreadsheets, and me professionally coming from a place where we're trying to kind of, in your words, you say like pushing spreadsheets 2.0 to non-technical users to replace databases, and coming from a company that's kind of pushing spreadsheets 2.0, I found this blog post really interesting and insightful. Would love for you to kind of quickly talk about what led you to write this blog post. I think from hearing about your experience at Perpay, I kind of got an idea, but wanted to hear from the source. What were you thinking about as you're writing this blog post, and what type of response have you received after publishing?
Yeah, so I would say the motivation for writing the post was honestly just like learning a lot more about operational teams, especially at, you know, at B2C companies. And I mean, the last B2C company that I worked at was Perpay. So that was definitely some background. And I learned a lot at Perpay, both about customer support, marketing, kind of all over the board. But really it was, I started when in the project that I discussed earlier about moving data to iterable, a lot of what I did was kind of help marketing QA the data that I had put into iterable initially in the development phase, just to make sure that like it was showing up in the emails in the way that kind of made sense in the way that they could use it. And when I was using the tool, it just dawned on me that there's so many features that we have in the software engineering world that have moved their, you know, that have made their way into the analytics and data engineering world that kind of exist in SaaS tools, but like not really. So for example, I talk about in the SaaS debt post, I talk about the three things of like templating. So how do you do things in a repeatable way? So the most obvious example to me in a marketing sense is like footers on emails, and even in Substack, right? You can have footers on a post where you don't have to copy and paste your outro and any social links. You just, it Substack automatically adds on every email. That's a template, really. Even in PowerPoint, right, we have templates, but we just don't think of them necessarily in that way. But to me, that is rare. Like that is really, really, really rare. And then how do you, okay, so now that you've actually built something, right, in a tool, or whether it be Iterable, whether it be Zapier, whether it be, you know, Zendesk, whatever, how do you actually test the thing? How do you test the thing that you built and make sure that, like, it does what you think it does? In data, we have tests. We have, whether it be Great Expectations, DBT tests, other data quality tools in software engineering, there are unit tests, whether it be PyTest or in whatever, in any other language. But the point is that like automated testing is really important, and everyone kind of knows it exists. Do they do it? Maybe sometimes it slips through the cracks, but we kind of all know we should. But testing, a lot of the time, right, in Zapier, right, if a Zap already exists and, you know, something happens in tool one and then something else needs to be put into tool two, initially when no one is looking at it, no one really cares. You can test it all you want. If it's deployed, though, and you're making a change, then you have to really think about how do you test it without affecting the production process. Maybe that's replicating the Zap and using like maybe it's dumping something in a Google Drive folder or something like that. And you create a testing Google Drive folder, but that takes effort, that takes the thought to think of doing that. And so that kind of leads me to the last idea, which is versioning. And what I mean by that is like tools like GitHub, GitLab, Bitbucket, but really based on Git for writing code, where you have the state of the world, which is your main branch. And even the concept of branching is like completely right. That like exists in software engineering, data and data world, not in operational world as much, but you have your state of the world. And then you have this other feature that you're working on. And then you propose a change where you say, hey, I want to make this change to the state of the world. Will other people review it and maybe like poke holes and see what I've done wrong? So then other people review it, and then you get some like, looks good to me, and then you merge it. And so now what the merge does is it changes the state of the world. The state of the world is new. But when you change the state of the world, maybe you introduced a bug, and maybe you introduced an unintentional thing that happens. How do you know what the previous state of the world was that didn't have this bug? The only way you know that is by versioning, is by storing all these changes and all of this history. And like, if anyone who codes, right, and uses Git, this is like just obscenely obvious, but in operational tools, it's not. It's really dependent on the tool itself. Some tools have versioning and they say, you know, track your changes or see changes. I mean, the most obvious example is like Google Docs, right? You can literally see all of the changes that everyone did, but not all tools have that. It's not the default. It's also, also within tools in Google Docs, you can see who made the changes. But if you're in maybe more of a collaborative tool and the marketing team is like 20 people and not just one, who made the change, right? And what is the process around making a change? And so to me, those are things that it struck me that weren't there in operational tools, but I think the value of having them is so, it's just a huge, huge, huge opportunity that there, it's both the opportunity for the tools to work better for their customers, as well as an opportunity for, right, there's room for like education in terms of what are these principles? How do you test things? How do you separate environments so that when you test something, it doesn't affect your end customers, really? What is versioning, right? Why do you want to see things historically? When something breaks, how do you debug, right? How do you understand, how do I make a change, whatever it is? What are my, you know, what are the actions to stop this issue from happening? And then also templating, right? I'm kind of going backwards a little bit, but how do you reduce redundancy? How are you just more efficient where you're not doing the same thing over and over and over and over again, but you're automating it? So the only thing that you're doing is like little things that are, or big things sometimes, but in either case that are unique to the task at hand. And so that's kind of what inspired me to write the post about SaaS.dat and the kind of things that I think about. But I do think it really stems from honestly just keeping a close eye on the broader SaaS ecosystem, whether it's data, whether it's marketing, whether it's future of work. And there are just so many different tools and everyone is just jumping at using them. But whenever you onboard a tool, right, you really have to understand the nuances of how it integrates into the rest of the ecosystem. And there are a lot of people that kind of write about that outside of data as well, which is very interesting. But there's just, whenever we onboard tools, we need to integrate them all together. And that has complexity in itself.
Got it. Wow, that was like a crash course in like software engineering for business folks, I feel like. Yeah, there's so much to unpack there. I know we're getting close to time. I think when you talk about MailChimp in your blog post, I think about like, you know, if you have a team of 10 marketing people working on MailChimp and someone swaps in this footer, someone swaps in this audience, and like, to your point, having versioning would help like figure out like, oh, who made that change and what did they do and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know if that information is readily available in MailChimp. Maybe it is through their API, but I'm guessing it's probably hard to come by in terms of like who did what in the last 2 weeks or something like that.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing that I kind of talked about in the post, which I think is really important, is like, what does it mean to build a scalable process? I don't mean code, I don't mean infrastructure like systems. I mean, there's that too. But what I really mean is, how do you set the scene and kind of build a process that can be done at scale, where you can send emails to both 5 people and tens of thousands of people, and the time you spend doing that is not linear, right? So I think Abe Gong of Superconductive talks about like the complexity carrying capacity. And that's like, with increased complexity, time might increase, but you don't want it to increase tenfold with tenfold complexity. If you have tenfold complexity and you can only, and you only spend 1.5x the time to achieve that same task, then that's extremely efficient.
Got it. Well, I could talk to you for many more hours, I think, about this subject, but I know we are getting close to the end. So templating, testing, versioning, looks like those are the three kind of big takeaways from this blog post and for all the data analysts out there. And Sarah, I was wondering if there's anything else that you want to quickly chat about before we sign off.
Nothing specifically to chat about, but would love for everyone to subscribe to my Substack. It's Sarah's newsletter at Substack, and more to come, versioning and all of that for ops, something I think about a lot. So stay tuned.
Yeah, I'll definitely include a link to the newsletter in the show notes. And Sarah, looking forward to reading What is SaaS Debt Part 2, whenever it comes out.
Awesome. Thanks, Al.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Sarah.